Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the talk show worth talking about, Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio, with your co-hosts, Kevin Hogan, founder of the Healing Stigma Program, and Scott Fullerton, voice of Left of Straight Radio. From A-list entertainers to hometown heroes, join Kevin and Scott as they interview those on the cutting edge of challenging stigma with insight, humor, and always compassion. Give them your ears and they'll open your mind. For positive talk with positive results, you're listening to Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio. Now here are your hosts, Scott and Kevin.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio. I am your co-host, Scott Fullerton, as always with my co-host, Kevin. We are coming at you on Thursday, August 18th. Actually, that's not true, is it, Kevin?
No, you got to tell the truth. Go ahead. Take them out of the time warp and let them take them behind the curtain.
We're taking you behind the magic of radio, boys and girls. We're actually recording the show on Friday, day after our show just aired last night. So we have a special guest today. It's only available for today only. We really thought it's a great story to bring to you. So we are taping on Friday, but you'll be hearing this on August 18th. So all sorts of good stuff happening. Kevin, how's your whole day been? We talked. We usually never talk for like 5 days. This is great.
Yeah. It's you know, with the way things go politically, the way things advance with the Olympics, it seems like there's, you know, a lifetime worth of news. I was just the other day, weren't you talking about the what was it? It was an article that was outing or doing something about Olympic athletes on some type of dating sites. I think I saw today that there was a total apology and rescinding of the article, but that it's still out there in other sites that have reposted the information, unfortunately. But that's how quickly this stuff changes.
Right, exactly. We were just talking about last night, just to fill you guys in, the Olympic Games, they had the Daily Beast reporter, Nico Hines. He was trying to do a kind of a human interest piece, what he thought would be a human interest piece, and the Daily Beast actually okayed it. But he went on to four different dating apps to kind of see who was hooking up at the games, kind of trying to get his provocative piece for the Daily Beast. But he's a straight married white male who made a Grindr profile and actually gave enough identifying information about three of the Olympians in the story that it was able to tell who they are. One of them was from, I believe it was, Kazakhstan, which it's illegal to be gay, and you can get like serious repercussions. So thank goodness the Daily Beast pulled that. They first they edited the report and took out the identifying information. The guy Nico never mentioned them by name, but he did give enough characteristics about them that you could figure out who they were. So first the Daily Beast removed that, and then today they pulled the entire article. One of the very few times they've ever pulled an article. So, but like you said, it's the ramifications are out there because we know what happens on the internet, right?
Well, I mean, it strikes a real familiar chord with those that know my backstory. I mean, for me, being outed, you know, in one news cycle in the news cost at the time my career, but it was also wound up being, you know, the push forward and the birth of the Healing Stigma program. So I can't deny that, you know, one door closes, another door opens. But in a situation like this, my heart goes out to an Olympic athlete, someone competing, and being outed in such a way, because, you know, once you can make those calculations or deductions or however, I forget what, you know, I think deductions, and you can figure it down to one or two people on a team that comes from a country where your sexual orientation is illegal and punishable by things like death. I mean, really? This is human interest? I mean, that's a macabre interest, if you ask me, especially for our whole entire community that should then be able to understand, you know, and we should also link together and understand what, you know, there is obviously good reporting that needs to be done on a whole bunch of levels, and good reporting needs to, you know, we need to support it and read it and all the rest. But something like this that has that kind of, you know, there was I think a female athlete from Tonga who she just happens to be out. She's a lesbian, but it still is illegal in her country, but she just she deals with it. You know, that's what she says. You know, I'm out, and she wrote about it, and she just said it gave her chills when she saw what this, you know, what this guy had done under the guise of, you know, responsible journalism. It gave her absolute chills for these people who are also extremely vulnerable when you're in a competition like this and you're already under media scrutiny. What that does to your mind and the rest of your, you know, if you're an athlete like that, your reputation, when stigma attaches to that, it's everything goes, you know, your community, your support can become very, very, very tenuous.
Exactly. Well, I'm just glad the Daily Beast did what's right. Hopefully, like you said, and I think it's going to be hard to scrub the internet completely, but hopefully people comply and understand that this is a big thing for a lot of people.
Well, they haven't. I've actually written out on social media and asked other, you know, I've written to other organizations to try and, you know, put pressure on those that haven't taken it down. So it's actually an ongoing thing, and they can check it out on the Healing Stigma Twitter account or whatever. So it is actually an ongoing thing, and I'm trying to have you know, other organizations pick up the kind of watchdog, and I think they will, because if this has been taken down by the Daily Beast in a policy, I mean, they didn't, and by the way, this is kind of unprecedented. They didn't just take it down. They really tried. They knew they did wrong. They really tried to scrub every bit of this article. You know what I'm saying? So they
right.
really went out of their way. And, you know, I mean, look at the case, what was it, the Gawker case there, and how much they said, you know, this is freedom of speech and everything else. And there's a lot that we have argued in this country that I support about freedom of speech. This is
right.
a very yeah. important thing here. But when they took the action they did, and now other websites continue to post that information, come on, now it's time to, you know, do the right thing.
Right. Well, it was a big mea culpa by them, and they really needed to, but good
yeah.
on them for doing that. But let's not waste
no.
any more time. We got another great
no.
story. We had a great story yesterday. We talked to fantastic Derek Davis yesterday, who had
yeah.
Done a bicycle and kayaking event, raising money for mental health awareness for Franklin County in Columbus.
Yeah.
We have another Ohio story today about fantastic service animals for mental health awareness as well. So I'm looking forward to this interview today.
Yeah, this is really amazing. Jane is someone who I read her story right away, and I was like, wow, this is somebody that just has my heart. People know about it. I have two adopted elderly dogs. I say they adopted me. Two elderly dogs now that were with me throughout the whole ambush, and I think in many ways they're along with my family, along with my lovely, lovely wife. It was those dogs that really got me sometimes out of my own misery and skin and made me started, you know, in caring for something else, got me up about and walking around a bit and saw, you know, I saw light that was, as I say, I saw light at the end of a tunnel that wasn't a train coming at me, fortunately. And so I was able to walk towards it and keep putting one foot positively, even when I didn't know necessarily where I was going to go. Those dogs helped me every foot of the way.
Well, this is a fantastic story, and just amazing the peace of mind that can bring to everybody. So let's go ahead.
Yeah,
not
get her on.
We're going to feature Andrew Heller today. He's a fantastic, he sings a la Frank Sinatra. He's not an impersonator. He does his own take, but he just released Frank Sinatra, My Way, with
wow.
his own interpretations of a bunch of really cool classic Frank Sinatra songs. We're going to start off with a little Summer Wind. When we come back, we're going to be talking to the amazing Jane Miller. You're listening to Healing Stigma on Left to Straight Radio. We'll be back in just a couple of moments.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea. It lingered there to touch your hair and walk with me. All summer long we sang a song, and then we strolled that golden sand. Summer wind, like painted kites, those days and nights they went flying by. Hyperman. One day it called to you. I lost you. I lost you to the summer wind.
And we are back. Again, that was Andrew Heller with Summer Wind. Guys, our guest today is a licensed psychotherapist and clinical social worker. She has received the Irene Saw Gross Award for Humanitarian Services and has contributed scholarly essays in professional journals and anthologies in the field of clinical social work. She is also the executive director of Healing Companions, a nonprofit whose mission is to assist individuals severely limited in their ability to function due to mental illness so they can lead lives with dignity, productivity, freedom, and self-reliance through the benefits of psychiatric service dogs. To that end, she's also written her own book titled Healing Companions, Ordinary Dogs and Their Extraordinary Power to Transform Lives. We are so excited to have her on the show today. Please welcome Jane Miller. Jane, how are you?
I'm doing very well. It's an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Well, it's our honor indeed. Thank you so much for coming. And I can't believe I see another fantastic fellow Ohioan here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, we're not even that far from each other. So
no, not at all.
I think I fit in quite nicely to what you're discussing because one of my missions regarding what I do and how I live my life is to take the I out of mental illness and change that to the we in mental wellness, and really we have to come together to destigmatize a mental illness in our culture because it still is very difficult for most people, and all of us have different levels of mental illness and mental health, but it's very difficult for people to feel safe and feel comfortable sharing their stories and sharing how their mental health has impacted their lives. And I think in this time, it's so essential that we discuss this openly and honestly so that people can feel they can share what they're going through and break the stigma and share our stories. And that's why I wrote the book that I wrote, because I really felt like people can really grow and learn and feel like they're not alone, because the isolation of stigma is so huge.
You had me, I'm a writer as well, so you know, you had me from the moment you took out the I and replaced it with we, changing illness to wellness. I mean, for our listeners, it pops off the page what you're doing. And, you know, there's no, I just also want to say there's no accident that, you know, what I do, the program, is Healing Stigma, and I didn't even know Jane at the time, and yours is Healing Companions. And like you said, when these programs, someone like Scott comes along, and I can tell you what Scott does in healing by providing these platforms every week with his own show on Left of Straight and the Healing Stigma radio program here, it's just an honor to meet you finally, Jane, because, and I don't know if our listeners would know my whole backstory, but when I was ambushed, and we're talking about the Daily Beast article, I was out reported to 1.5 million viewers in a 24-hour news cycle. And I tell you, you know, the best thing in the world, other than having a lovely family, a loving wife, was the fact that my dogs didn't look any differently at me the day afterwards, when I felt everyone else in the world was looking at me through some type of a, you know, stigmatizing lens, and I was literally at the end of my wits. Those dogs just looked at me in the same exact way they did the day before. And, you know, so my hat goes off to you, Jane, and what you do in your program. But what I really want to hear, and I know Scott has great questions as well, I want to hear where the idea came from, if there was a, you know, a point for you. I'll tell you mine just quickly with dogs. My father, I'm the son of a letter carrier, who the only time he almost got written up by a postal inspector was because he carried milk bones instead of pepper spray. So he had all the dogs. I grew up probably figuring out how to walk by hanging on to a dog. So I grew up with dogs, and it still brings me as close as I can to going out for walks and collecting my thoughts as a writer. I say if I had a goldfish, I'd be dead. But with dogs, I actually go out, think, and walk around in nature and meet my neighbors. And I think it makes me a better person. But I'd love to hear where this idea came from, you know, for you.
Okay. So, you know, life is such a journey. And it's always very hard to put into a short, especially it's like with Twitter these days, to paraphrase where it all begins in our lives, our journeys, because I don't know that we really know where it begins. So and I'll start with fourth grade. I don't know how old most of you are, but they're listening. But when I was growing up, it was the 60s, and there was a whole huge section of the world that was aware of the seal battering, the pups, the beautiful seal pups out in Alaska.
It was the birth of Greenpeace. I remember when I was a kid. That's the first time I remember it, was when they started publicizing it.
Yeah, and pre-Greenpeace, there was an organization called Save Our Seals. Well, when I was in fourth grade, we had to read all these articles about what was happening in the world, and one of the articles was about the battering of these seal pups, and I was mortified. I was totally like, oh my God, why would you kill seals for fur? And this is outrageous. So, to make a long story short, I came home from school and I told my mother I wanted to be Jane Goodall when I grew up. Well, I'm not Jane Goodall.
That's really cool.
But I am Jane Miller. And I knew at that moment that I had to figure out some way to save the lives of animals and humans, and I didn't know how that would all align.
What a great connection, animals and humans. You knew it,
I knew right then. And at the same time, I became a very strict vegetarian, and I've been one ever since. So this was fourth grade. So, and I write in my book, and there's a wonderful piece in my book about where this all began, but I spoke about my dog Tasha, and you know, I really think that her entrance into my life when I was going through being a teenager was really the impetus to all of this. But it goes further than that. So, if you don't mind, if I read a little short, very brief piece
You can relax. Okay. This show is not a Twitter account. This show is about giving people like you the time to tell us the story you want. So you go, dear.
Okay.
You've got time.
So how the healing journey began. Several years ago, I discovered something powerful about the dogs who share many of our lives. Though all dogs provide love, comfort, joy, and support, for some people, dogs actually have the ability to transform lives. Although I've been in clinical practice as a therapist for years, this isn't something I learned through professional training. The catalyst was a tiny furball named Umaya, who came home with me on Christmas Eve. Here's how our journey began. After a dozen years of working and attending a graduate school, I finally moved into my own home in October 1992. My first priority was to get a dog. Furniture could wait. As a child of divorce, I recall the most memorable life-altering gift my father ever gave us was a black Labrador retriever pup we named Tasha. As I grew up, she was my best friend, confidant, and especially while going through the trials and tribulations of adolescence, Tasha taught me how extraordinary the bond between a human and an animal can be, and I always knew that once I had a home of my own, I wanted to find another Tasha. However, I also knew If I adopted another black lab, she might remind me too much of Tasha's absence. And even eventually, I fell in love with a breed with a similar disposition, the beautiful dark golden retrievers. When I started to look for my new dog, I discovered a breeder of goldens less than 5 miles away from my home. At our first meeting, I was greeted by a boy aged about 17 years who lived with his family on the farm where they raised the dogs. As a child, he had suffered a serious accident when the combine he was riding went up in flames. And although he had survived, he still bore the scars of his accident, despite numerous plastic surgeries and skin grafts. As we walked out into the yard to meet the dogs, he told me how he started breeding the dark golden retrievers after the accident, and he credited the dogs for giving him back his life. The dogs accepted him completely for who he was, not what he looked like. I was so touched by his story and seeing how deeply the dogs loved him, I knew I'd find my pup here. The next litter was due October 30th. I could hardly wait. When the day finally came for me to meet the litter, the first pup I picked up crawled happily into my lap, but after a few moments, she got frisky, and when I put her down, she immediately peed. I knew at that moment she was the one because she wouldn't pee on me. We painted her toenails purple so we would know she was mine, and I named her Amaya, which means stability. And a few weeks after Amaya entered my life, I received her AKC papers to discover that her dam's name was Tasha. Through the stories of these dogs, I hope to show you, a friend or a family member, how he or she might benefit from such a healing companion. And it goes on. But that hopefully answers the question of how my journey began.
That's lovely.
One of those stories, thank you. It's one of those stories where your journey kind of takes you where you belong. And
yeah.
I just feel like Umaya led me to this, and it's always what I should have been, what I was meant to be doing, I guess I'd say.
Beautiful.
And
that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that with us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, you're welcome. And I think for me, I really believe in helping the disenfranchised, and my work is three pillars. We're saving the lives of shelter dogs while we're transforming the lives of those with mental illness, as well as the dog's basic training is provided by inmates at the local prison that I train in dog training, so they have skills so that when they are released, they can get jobs and hopefully stay out of
prison. A whole nother stigma that you're helping heal right there by getting people to have a skill when they, because we know that we've spoken, Scott and I have spoken about this a number of times, and we were even kind of mentioning it, Jane, I think, you know, before we started the formal interview here, but you just mentioned that third pillar, and I'm like, I was ready to jump on it, because allowing people to go out with a skill, instead of going out wondering, oh my God, what do I do if someone finds out that I have a record and you're trying to get a job, you're trying to feed your family or whatever, wow, that's fantastic. That third pillar is amazing. Well done.
Well, and I think as many of us know, the recidivism for inmates is so huge. And one of the biggest reasons is because they can't make livable wages. And I now have two inmates. One just recently, as a matter of fact, a week ago, was released. And the other one was released a year ago. And I helped get him a job at a doggy daycare where he's making
Brilliant.
A livable wage. And, you know, that's really... it's wonderful to be able to do that. And to have them end up getting the benefits of training dogs and the bond that's formed with the dogs
right.
in the prison. And I teach
right.
all the inmates relaxation stress reduction techniques for the animals as well as for the humans. So they
Brilliant.
Also benefit from learning how to meditate and do relaxation stress reduction techniques for the animals as well as themselves.
Great. Well, let's go ahead and talk about healing companions just a little bit. I want to start with what actually psychiatric service dogs, let's talk about that in general. What does it take? What do you have to do to be qualified to be able to participate in the program?
Okay. The psychiatric service dogs became available to the public in the mid-1990s when the American Disabilities Act was enacted, and that changed the whole landscape for people with mental illness because they then were fitting under the criteria of having severe limitations in their ability to function. So, right. you know, we've known about guide dogs for years, but
right.
in the when the American Disabilities Act was enacted, it opened the gates for many other people with disabilities to have rights that weren't present previously. And the first thing is it's less about the dog, it's about the human. The person has to be, it's not about your diagnosis, it's about that you're severely limited in your ability to function due to mental health, mental illness. So it's if you have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, that it's to the degree that you can't function or it makes it very difficult for you to function. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about why now a service dog is essential for you. Does that
right.
help? Does that?
Yeah, definitely.
So
right.
it,
and
I know go ahead.
It can be the substantially limit one or more major life activities, such as caring for oneself, speaking, breathing, concentrating, thinking, eating, communicating, sleeping, and working. And a lot of folks with health
yep.
issues have real difficulty with activities of daily living. And as you know,
yeah.
dogs in and of themselves, even without being trained, the tasks that they're trained to do, perform for that individual, and I'll go into that in a moment, to help us with our routines. Dog, there's nobody
yes.
in Ohio that has a dog that won't wake them up in the morning to take have them take them out. And I don't
yeah.
know about you, but I would not want to go outside without clothes on. So it forces you to get dressed and take your dog out, and hopefully when you come back in, you feed your dog, so hopefully you feed yourself. So
yeah.
dogs come,
yeah.
Have a routine, which is so good for people that struggle
yeah.
with that. So,
yeah.
Well, I also want you to talk about for the psychiatric service dogs, there's not really a specific rule of thumb for a breed of dog, too. It can be all sorts of different dogs, correct?
Yes, and I will say, for me, I would much prefer to start with a dog that's a year and a half or two, because most of my clients can't handle puppies. I mean, God, they can barely take
right.
care of themselves, try taking care of a puppy. So
mm-hmm.
the dogs, all the dogs we place in our program, and different programs do it differently, are shelter dogs. And the nice thing about, there are many benefits to this. One is that they're older, and when a dog is about 2 years old, we can then do tests like knowing if they have hip dysplasia or some other health
right.
issues. Because the training process in and of itself is extremely tedious and long and extensive. Because
yeah.
unlike a well-trained dog, we're asking these dogs to go to work with you every day and be out in environments that many dogs would not be comfortable going into, like
right.
going into a grocery store. Most dogs are hoovers. I call them hoovers. They pick up everything they see on the floor. And you can't
right.
you can't have a dog that will do that. You also train the dog from things that you would not consider, like how to tuck their tail, so that when
yeah.
they're at a restaurant, their tail isn't sticking out from the table.
Right.
We teach the dogs to not shake. You know how when a dog's been lying down for a long time, when it first gets up, it shakes
right.
its body and hair will go
yeah.
all over the place. Well, can you imagine going out of a restaurant and having your dog shake all over? And
yeah.
I don't think people would like that very much. But the training that's the most interesting, I think, and most unique for people with mental health issues is that no two clients of mine have the same symptoms. So unlike
right.
a guide dog, every guide dog is trained to do the same thing. But with the dogs I train for the clients that come to me, is trained different tasks. So, for example, one person might have an eating disorder, and the dog will block them from going to the refrigerator. And or if they starve themselves or don't eat frequently enough, we'll go get food for them every few hours. Another dog
hmm.
might wake someone up from a nightmare, not only wake them up, but lead them out of bed and lead them into the living room and go and retrieve the remote control and have them watch TV. So that the nightmare is no longer affecting them. Another dog might paw or nudge the person if they start to have panic attacks. You know, so the creativity and the tailoring of these dogs to that specific person's needs is huge. And that's why unlike guide dogs or dogs for people with hearing impairment or mobility issues, we work with a small number of folks because you really have to work very closely with them, and we have very high ethical standards, and we want the quality to be very, very essential to meeting that one person's needs so that they can function at a higher level.
So. Right. Yeah, that's what I thought was very interesting, because you do have to, like you said, for a lot of the other service dogs, it's pretty much a routine where anyone can teach it, but you guys really involve the person that's going to be handling the dog because they do have those individual needs, right? So they are a lot more involved in the training than most others are.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And let me say more about that. So how the program works is the dogs go through their basic training, sit, come, heel at the prison. And once they pass what's called their class test, very similar to the CGC, which is the Canine Good Citizen test, then once we have someone that we want to see if it's a good match for, we do a meet and greet and make sure that the dog is the right dog for them, and they have their meet and greet. And then the person that this dog is going to be their service dog adopts the dog. So the dog is living with them, and they are kind of, I guess I'd say, co-training their dog with me, because I'm the trainer that trains them how
right,
to train their dog.
Right.
So it's a very interesting, the whole process of training their own dog can be also very therapeutic for them, because they see that they can communicate with this animal and have this animal listen to them and behave and be appropriate out in public. And it's a great self-confidence builder for them. And it also, they have now, they're going out in public, and a lot of my folks that I've worked with over the years have real serious issues with going out in public and being in public.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So just the fear in and of itself of going out to the grocery store or a bank or anywhere is huge. But now they have this dog beside them. And it's so interesting because they're so scared of going out in public and having people make them uncomfortable or whatever, or, you know, just feel isolation can be very, provide safety for them. And so it's very,
yeah.
It feels very unsafe. And
hey,
not
Jane?
The dog makes them, yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm Irish, so I do that all the time. You'll forgive me. But I'm just wondering, because naturally, if you see, I mean, and again, I think sometimes how, you know, people can stigmatize totally unnecessarily or whatever, but I'm just curious because you're with it and you see this now all the time. And, you know, I'm learning more every day thanks to this show, and I think this is fantastic what you're doing, and I have heard of it. But I'm wondering if you ever find that naturally if someone has, say, a cane and they're with a guide dog, and it's obviously that the person is blind and it's a, you know, it's a seeing eye dog, and we've been, you know, over the years we've been exposed to that more, do you still find any time that, say, businesses or people don't understand why this dog is a service dog, you know, because oftentimes one of the things about mental illness is because you can't necessarily see it per se, it's one of those things that isn't talked about and oftentimes is stigmatized because it's supposed to be secretive and people don't get treatment, blah, blah, blah. But are there times that this isn't, you know, that you find you have to almost educate the public as much as you're training, say, the dog and the client? I'm just curious.
And educating the client how to handle it. So, yeah,
right.
To answer that question, we are confronted all the time, all the
really?
Time. And part of the whole process is kind of role modeling of how to handle these situations. I'll give
yeah.
you a great example. We walked into Drug Mart. I shouldn't say the name of the place, but we walked into a store, a local store in our town, and the manager tried to kick us out and with my client and their service dog in training. And and I called them and I talked to the manager and I told them the law. And,
yeah.
you know, it's amazing. They now have service dogs welcome sign on all their stores, and it's fabulous.
Great.
But no, we get this all the time. And I will tell you, it really is interesting to see the evolution of my clients, because at the very beginning, they're very uncomfortable with confrontation and don't really want...
Of course.
It's not, you know, what my issues are. and get very, very nervous answering. And I'm like, you don't have to. They have no right to know why you have service dogs. And you can very easily say many service dogs are trained for people with invisible disabilities. This can include diabetic alert dogs, seizure alert dogs.
Right.
Those dogs that are trained for chemical sensitivity.
Yeah.
So it's very nice that now we have lots of dogs for invisible disabilities. And I have other clients that want to shout out to the world, I'm mentally ill. This is my psychiatric service dog. Which, you know, good for them. You know, that's where they're at. And I think that's wonderful that they feel that it's time to come out. And
isn't it interesting that the dog in some ways is a catalyst for this conversation that ultimately then is able to, because we know how wonderful they are, they're ultimately able to bear the weight of that conversation. And then, as you said, the confrontation just becomes maybe more of an exercise that can be diffused. And then the person is able to come out into the world and be part of the world. How wonderful for the community. And you're educating the businesses as well. And it's on the shoulders of these wonderful animals that are allowing it to happen.
Exactly.
Well,
and
I want to kind of dovetail into there if I can for a second, guys. I read a great article while I was doing some research for the show today, and it addresses both of what you both were talking about. It says, people with psychiatric service dogs are often faced with several problems that other service dog handlers typically do not experience. While guide dogs for the blind and hearing impaired and helper dogs for people who use wheelchairs are well known to the public, dogs for psychiatric conditions are not. Further adding, it was that many people with psychiatric conditions do not appear to have anything externally wrong with them. And because of the heavy social stigma of the mental illness, the handler may be reluctant to explain their condition or the dog's trained task, even in the vaguest of terms.
Well, what I was going to say is my clients, I've taught them to, if they don't feel comfortable and the store is allowed to ask them what tasks the dogs are trained to do, they can't ask you what your disability is because that's private matters.
Yeah.
But my clients will say, my dog is a medical alert dog. And that's very clear. That says my dog alerts me to my medical condition. And they have panic attacks or whatever. So I think that we have really come a long way. We have a long way to go. And I love what you just said about that the dogs are the catalyst because and help the person feel safe enough to talk and communicate.
Yeah.
Because many of my clients couldn't even speak out in public and now are doing presentations with me. And
that's brilliant.
It's because they're talking about their dog, and they love talking about their dog. And so that's
it's another form of expression. The form of expression allows communication instead of self-loathing, instead of hiding, instead of secrecy, instead of stigma.
Right.
This dog allows these conversations, plural, to happen out in public in the community and say, look, if this service dog is helping me, I'm not a bad person. This dog is here to help me because I deserve this and I deserve to live like anyone else does in part of the community as healthy as I can be. And I just got to insert this. My family, just instinctually, this is what I grew up with. My grandfather was a fireman and wound up later in his life suffering a terrible stroke, but he was much, much older. But then this big, big Irishman came to live with us. Now, his whole time as a firefighter, he always said this. They would get to the fires, and this is in Boston, you know, the old, you know, five-story walk-ups made of wood. And it's like the first thing they would look for, did the family have a dog? If the dog was outside more than 99% of the time, the whole family was out. If they couldn't find the dog, they knew there was a family member still inside there. And he always said, it was crazy, but he always said, you know, a smoke detector can run out of batteries. He says, you love a dog? He says, it'll die trying to get you out of a fire. So, you know, I know it was a practical thing, but they grew up with this. And it was instilled in me, and like I said later with my dad, loving dogs in that way. But then later for me, I would just say in all of this, the thing that gets me is I had a this terrible, terrible experience. And some people say the last dog you can train is a Chihuahua. But I got to say this, and maybe you'll get it. On the day after the ambush happened, everybody was scared to come near me, and I lay there almost in a paralytic state.
and a Chihuahua that I absolutely adore. Now 13, my other dog is a Pendenko, is 14, but the Chihuahua jumped up on my chest, looked right at me with almost wisdom, and said, "You know, you're getting up and you're going to walk me." And normally I didn't walk him so much, my wife would, and I would walk the other dog. But that Chihuahua looked at me and said, "You are getting up and walking me right now." And it was amazing. It was really, it got me up, and that was the first walk I had. And even though I didn't know where the others were going to come from, the smallest little dog with the biggest heart got me up and out of my own funk.
Yep, it's amazing. It really is.
So,
and
I'm a believer.
Yeah, it's really, I will tell you, I've been a therapist almost 30 years, and what I've seen that service dogs can do for my clients is more than all the therapy, all the pills in the world, because my clients now have jobs. They're living productive lives because they have a dog that goes to work with them every day and you know, helps them when they're entering into a panic episode or whatever. The other piece to this that I think is very interesting that many people don't think about is, so if you come out about being severely limited in your ability to function due to mental illness, the world starts to see mental illness differently, because I hate to say this, most people, if you say you're an incest survivor or you're DID, which is multiple personality disorder, have these very warped senses of Sybil and someone that's homeless, or, I mean, not to pronounce the homeless people, but, you know, mental illness is so stereotyped and not understood that in many ways the comment that my clients get is, "You can't be mentally ill. You look fine. I love that, you know?
Right.
Like, what does it look like to be to have mental health issues?" And I think it really helps to have people see that we're all people. And I think this is something that happened with, you know, LGBT community, that you can't be gay. I know you.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, why can't I, you know, you don't look gay, you know, all this crap. And it's that same kind of breaking those barriers of what is mental health, and I think sometimes it scares people, makes them question themselves, but it also makes them see that people with severe mental illness can function. And I'll give you a great story, which is pretty disturbing, but it exposes this. I did a presentation, Grand Rounds, at the Cleveland Clinic, a very traditional hospital with the psychiatry department. And my client, who is severely mentally ill, she's a trauma survivor, and she's DID, she's multiple personality disorder. And they had the audacity to say there's no way she could be DID and have gone through what she tells us she's gone through. She wouldn't be able to function at the level she's functioning. Because this is what's so sad. These are psychiatrists. They are so hopeless and so unaware of what is feasible for people.
Right, right.
And
because we haven't seen it, it can't exist.
Exactly.
Yep.
And
yep,
for them,
yep.
Their whole industry is about pills and medication.
Right.
And, you know, so you can medicate people, but they're not going to be able to function. And, I mean, they were so stunned that someone could live such a quality life.
Yeah.
You know, and not to say that there aren't struggles, but, you know, we all have those. That they don't even believe, you know, for me, I believe my
Isn't
clients,
it amazing? Jane, I just have to jump in there and say this, that oftentimes, and I work with this oftentimes in stigma sensitivity workshops that I do, which is healthcare providers sometimes are a very large, let's put it this way, still at times a disproportionate number of healthcare providers unknowingly stigmatize. And what they were doing here is they were literally stigmatizing because they couldn't imagine someone, as you're saying, that functioning, because anyone that would have that amount of problems, they're already thinking the amount of scripts, the amount of prescriptions they would be writing and what that person would probably look. I'm guessing. I don't know. But, you know, in other words, to them, this was impossible. So, therefore, their minds professionally were so informed that it couldn't, it literally couldn't happen. And that's an amazing story of professionals that therefore must, in every single day, if it doesn't fit their narrow expectation, they must be therefore saying, you know, your disability doesn't exist, and they would be then therefore misdiagnosing as well or stigmatizing. It's horrible, but it's true. I see that all the time.
Yeah. And
interesting story. Yeah, it is.
And,
very tragic.
And I want to go back to another story that when we were talking about how people have this ability to accept, or I don't know if accept, but, you know, invisible disabilities are not, people aren't aware of what's going on, and that's harder for people to conceptualize.
Yeah.
When we go out,
well, think about it. They go to the media. They go to what oftentimes people the default is, which is, you know, they hear the stories every night of the news. You know, it's always with that same kind of reporter's downward trend after the next violent thing. You know, the person, a neighbor said they believed he suffered from mental illness and was off his meds, and that's like, and then it cuts to something, and that's the last thing you hear. If you ever notice how it's edited, oftentimes, how many nights do you hear that? And that's what oftentimes the general public is bombarded with, and then, like you said, the person in the office with a service dog winds up getting the brunt of all that because they're there to them, like, you can't have this disability. You look too normal to me.
Right, and you hear the next line. You don't hear the next line being, and they were getting really quality care that was free. You know, and you know, it's like this insanity if we blame the victims. And they're not even victims, they're survivors. But we blame people for not being, first of all, can't speak of what's going on. You know, maybe they're hearing voices or whatever because they'll be stigmatized. Then if they do bring it up, where do they go? I mean, there's no care available. And who's funding this? And certainly this, you know, as much as mental health has gotten better, it's still tragic that health care isn't available to people with mental illness. And what you see now is that the majority of inmates now need mental health care, and they're not getting it, you know. And
huge point.
And to be honest, the majority of people that are killing people are not necessarily mentally ill. Mentally ill folks, more often than not, kill themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just
the harm they do themselves is far greater. You're right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think...
Yeah. All right, guys, we're going to go ahead and take a break for a second here. But let's go ahead and...
Scott's the timekeeper.
I'm the keeper of the time here. I want to go ahead and move on, take a quick break. When we come back, I want to hear all about the organization, Healing Companions, and about the book. So let's go ahead and take another quick break here. We're going to play another Andrew Heller, My Kind of Town. Little Sinatra, you're listening to Healing Stigma on Left to Straight Radio. We're talking to Jane Miller today. We'll be back in just a couple of moments.
Now this could only happen to a guy like me, and only happen in a town like this. So may I say to each of you most gratefully, as I throw each one of you a kiss, this is my kind of town, Chicago. My kind of town, Chicago is. My kind of people, too. People who smile at you, and each time I roam, Chicago is calling me home, Chicago. Kind of razzmatazz. Chicago is one town that won't let you down.
Back. That was Andrew with My Kind of Town. Guys, we're talking to Jane Miller. She's the executive director of Healing Companions. Jane, talk about the group. I mean, you have an amazing 12 board of directors, everywhere from honorary positions like Muriel Hemingway to PhDs to political and fundraising experts. How the organization gets started, and talk about your volunteers and your fundraising.
Oh, thank you very much. Before we became a nonprofit, 501c3 nonprofit, I was providing psychiatric service dogs to folks, and it became apparent that the need was greater than the funding we had.
Right.
At that point, we weren't really able to get the funds we needed without being a nonprofit.
Yeah.
So even though we'd been doing this for, 10 years or more, it became apparent that it was time to really get ourselves in a better position and better leverage. And I have always been a wonderful networker and loved getting in touch with people. And this really was wonderful when I was writing my book, because I got endorsements on my book from some very exceptional folks and got invited to present with them. And
good on
so
you. Good on you.
Yeah, that spread the word quite a bit, which is wonderful. But I started the nonprofit because so many of the people that really had the need for a psychiatric service dog didn't have the funds for them. And my view is that I need to make sure that these dogs are getting the quality care that they deserve and that they need. And that really, that comes first, I guess I'd say, because for me, they don't have voices, and we're their voices, and we need to make sure that they are getting the quality care that they need. And so we went through the process of becoming a nonprofit, and for those of you that don't know, that's a bit of a cumbersome process through the IRS, and that took over a year. And when you go through the process of becoming a 501c3 nonprofit, it gives you a tax deductible status, so that when people make donations, they can take it off as a tax write off. It also makes it feasible for you to get grants, which opens up some doors that are really helpful. But you need to have a board of directors. And I was very blessed because I have some wonderful people in my life that are highly educated, also some of which are fundraisers, as well as very competent at grant writing. Wanted to be a part of our board because they care so much about what I'm doing. One of them was Joanne Bazzaglo, Kay Zuckerman. They really were the founders with me of Healing Companions Incorporated. And I think what happens with many nonprofits like ours, it's a small entity, and so it's mainly built through friends and family and, you know, people that love you and care about you and that have the passion, but don't necessarily have the skill sets. So over the years, we've now really branched out to expand our skill sets, gaining people with really wonderful skill sets to join our board. Matter of fact, speaking to you right now, we just have two more applicants that are going to be joining us because they volunteered. What happens so often is people volunteer with us, and over time, they really are doing over and above and really find the dedication they have to what we're doing so critical to their life that they join our board.
That's
a really wonderful way, because they already know what we need, and what, you know, they might be someone who specializes in social media or fundraising.
Yep.
So we have all different areas covered. And I've been very blessed with, I don't know if you've heard of crowdfunding, but when
we actually had a guest on, wasn't that what Derek did, was crowdfunding?
Yeah, he crowdfunded for his bicycle ride. Yeah, huh? For his
bicycle. We just had a guest who was crowdfunding for another a great adventure that was speaking out. Another Ohioan that was giving all the funds, I believe, to a local healthcare facility that was helping with mental illness, also in your area. So you guys are wonderful.
You probably heard about the Mental Health America in Franklin County.
That's it.
Oh my
That's
God.
It. Yep.
We have to connect. We definitely have to connect. So. Yeah. There are wonderful crowdfunding general fund drives that were specifically for shelter dogs. And through that, we won a 6-month membership to an organization called Catch a Fire, which has probably changed my life in more ways than you can imagine.
What's that?
Catch a Fire is an organization that provides very highly skilled, talented people, a pool of people that join Catch a Fire, and they send them their resumes and what their interests are. And Catch a Fire works with nonprofits where you can do projects. So it can be your business plan, your press kit, your website content, board hiring, human resources. So we have really, Google Analytics, we have benefited from 6 months of this free membership where you have three projects for as long as they take, about a month, to complete, and then you go on to three more. And through this, I have now had three people join our board from Catch a Fire and met some of the most talented. I mean, these are people working for major companies that just want to do something that makes them feel that they're giving back, because a lot of these companies are very large corporations that they love what they do, but they would like to know that they're also helping a nonprofit and are, like I said, have skill sets that are phenomenal. So through that,
isn't that interesting, Jane? I'm sorry to jump in, but there's three lives that each one of these saves, because in some ways. All right, so the person who then joins the board, I also have to just throw out here so that you know, I'm a board member of a 501c here in Boston that's the nation's first and oldest bisexual-specific human rights organization for bisexual people and for getting the help. It's the Bisexual Resource Center. So I'm on the board and found my community after the ambush that happened to me, talking about, a life-saving, life-changing event and finding your skills and going forward with it, because in the LGBT community, the violence, the homelessness, as well as, and Scott and I have talked about this as well, sometimes that bi erasure that even happens from, the gay community saying, well, you're not really bisexual, you're just half on your way to being gay. But in this, I didn't mean to take this over, but the realization I just had is, you work with dogs that are older, which oftentimes are the ones that aren't adopted, I realize, that have an incredible skill set. You also have people now that will join the board that have an incredible skill set. Isn't it amazing? Now, the patient or the client who also has an incredible skill set because they're going through something and coming out the other side, actually that person is incredible as well. Mental illness, it doesn't make them incredible, but an incredible person going through something that is challenging oftentimes becomes something greater or finds themselves and their identity out the other side. We know that. But I just realized that the person joining the board, as well as the dog that you adopt, allow to use a greater skill set by sharing this vision in some way. The hair just went up on the back. It's a lovely story. It really is.
Thank you. Well, and the other piece of this is that when you look at it, the cost ratio, the positive, let me rephrase that. When you look at that, every inmate's costing us $60,000 a year, that every person that's living off of Social Security is costing the state all this money, and my clients are now working full time, and they're out in the world, and so when you, the cost benefit ratio is amazing,
amazing.
People say, but it's so much money to have a service dog. Yeah, it is, but look how many lives you are impacting, and not just those lives that we just touched on, but every time you go out into public, you are educating every person that sees you in the grocery store. The little kid that screams, "Can I pet your dog?" No, my dog's working right now. you know, and then becomes educated and learns about someone that.
And the other thing that you said in the beginning, think about how many people here that are either going to, that currently need, you know, healthcare dealing with mental illness that need it, or people that are going to be coming out of something traumatic. Because I also I serve in a working party with the Health and Human Services on helping build trauma-informed congregations with interfaith leaders. You know, and the thing that I notice in all of this is these numbers we know are, you know, with affordable healthcare and everything else, we've got to get ways of not, as you said, not, and I'm not trying to say that medication doesn't work for people in part of a, you know, in part of a general regimen that includes,
right,
know, counseling, whatever. For, you know, and as you said, every person's journey is different. But this is amazing because what you're also doing here is, every time someone is stigmatized, every time someone is ostracized from the community, oftentimes we know those are the instances that can come back and wind up harming the community in such a horrific way later and costing so much in unfathomable pricing. You know, I'm not talking about dollars here, you know, but this is an example. What was it, Scott? Our very first guest, Rachel Griffin, said she wrote her musical, We Have Apples, about the fact that she said when she was studying music and writing lyrics, she didn't see anyone up on stage with mental illness in a positive role model way. So she decided to go out and write something and express something where someone – so you're creating it in real life, your expression of this. And I want to ask how the book came about because that's – I know Scott is going to interrupt any second because he's watching the clock and he's good at this. But the thing I really like here is that you're actually creating in real life role model examples that then go out and, as you said, have numerous conversations in a given week that normally wouldn't happen. And all of them oftentimes are having that knock-on effect of being a positive role model, someone interacting with, you know, with a mental illness that can actually go out and be part of the community. I think that it deserves such applause, really.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So should I answer that question where the book all transpired?
Please do. Yeah, I can't wait to hear about the book. Yeah, go.
So it's a fun, as I said, I'm kind of a go-getter. And so I am not one that's frightened of making a phone call because you can always hang up on me. I don't really care. I won't, you know, that doesn't bother me. So
I your spirit.
And I like doing research, so I looked up every number under the sun. I find people. And I found Oprah Winfrey. Everybody finds Oprah Winfrey. But and this was in the time when she had her show, and I was like, I've got to get on Oprah. She loves dogs. This was before Ellen was on.
Yep.
So I was like, I've got to get on Oprah. And it was kind of funny because thank God it didn't happen, but that's a whole other story. Well, amazingly enough, I got through. And I got through to the publicist there because I really know how to do this kind of stuff. And my other life, I should have been a researcher, whatever. So I get through the publicist, and the publicist loves what we do and is really gung-ho, thinks it's phenomenal, and says to me, you need to write a book. And I said, I need to write a book.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, my gosh, okay. So then I got through to another show and another show, and all I just kept hearing, I have to write a book, you have to write. So what I learned through this process is you become an expert when you've written the book. And you also have the ability to then be more renowned and capable of saying, look, this is really important information. And with statistics, with scientific evidence-based research that shows the effectiveness. And so I just was like, I'm going to write a book. And that's kind of where it all came up. This is so hysterical. And so my book, and I got an agent. I did a ton of research, found a woman that is an amazing agent who's been an agent for numerous dog books. And I couldn't have done it
so
without
smart.
Her. And I did all the research of how to do a proposal, the whole thing. And I had people that have written books that worked with me. And so really my book is people's stories. It's exposing the stories so that through those stories you can understand the pros and cons of psychiatric service dogs, that you can also have. There's one chapter about how family members might react to your service dog or your partner. There's, like I said, there's pros and cons, and frequently when you get a service dog, if you have a partner, they might feel like all of a sudden they're not needed, and that can be really difficult then in regard to the relationship. So we go over everything. We go through a whole chapter, The Golden Years, which looks at how to deal with the loss of the dog and the dog's retirement, so that the person gets a really good sense of the whole process. And
that's great.
So I wrote my book, got it published, and this is before it was announced that Oprah was going off the air. I get a phone call from the publicist. It's kind of comical. And she says to me, "Well, I see that your book did come out," she remembered. And she said, "But Oprah, I have to tell you, and this is confidential, she's going off the air. Would you be willing to come and be on Oprah if there's a cancellation at a short notice?" I'm like, "I'll be there." So that's the beginning of the book journey. And I had never got on Oprah, obviously. But it was good that I didn't, because I don't know if you know about the Oprah effect. All of a sudden you get so famous that you can't really do what you do and provide the numbers that we would have gotten calls for and, you know, really done it in the way that would have been appropriate. So back to our 501c3, just to say that we're always looking for volunteers. And when I say volunteers, you know, if you have a skill that you think would be beneficial, whether it's Facebook putting posts up or doing tweets for us or sending out our fundraising letter, we always need people to help us with fundraising. Like I said, it costs up to $20,000 to fully train a psychiatric service dog for one person. And most of my clients do not have that kind of money. So most of my time is volunteer work, and that's fine, but it's really important that we get as much funding as possible that goes directly to the inmates as well as to the mental health.
Well, it saves the lives of dogs, and it changes the lives of people.
I mean, I just want to go back to the book for 2 seconds, too. You were talking about some of the endorsements of your book. You had Temple Grandin, who was just Academy Award-winning story on her last year. That's just amazing. I mean, you've had some great endorsements of the book. I think you should be very proud of it.
Well, thank you. And the other person below that, Alan Schoen, he wrote Kindred Spirits. And I had the real pleasure, as a matter of fact, one of the catalysts to getting me to write my book. I ended up presenting with him at a very large holistic health conference in Hilton Head called NICABM, NICABM, and he really changed my life too. And he's one of those people that, like we were talking about earlier, about when someone's told that they can't really live a full life, very often people say that this dog is not going to be able to be a service dog. And I guess I'm one of these people that just believe that, you know, dogs can conquer things that we can too. And I always hope and really believe in that a lot of this work is the bond that we form with them and learning how to communicate with them. So it's really quite magical.
All right, it's a dialogue, isn't it?
But I definitely want to talk about fundraising. You guys are doing some great work with different outside groups as well. I see that you're working with in Kevin's neck of the woods in Massachusetts on Tuesday, August 30th. You're working with MJ's Pet Training Academy in Acushnet, Mass. They're doing you pick your own how much you want to pay for a dog bath, and they're going to donate half the proceeds, whatever you pay, back to the organization. They've done that twice in July.
Oh, how wonderful!
It's cool to have groups like that are supporting you. That's fantastic.
And this was really cool. They met us on Facebook, and they loved what we were doing so much. They contacted us and asked if they could do 3 days of just a percentage of all the money that comes into their pet training and grooming facility will go to Healing Companions.
That's wonderful.
And just to say, the other way people really can give us money is a beautiful way, which is through Amazon Smiles. If you go to our website and you can help us in the donate page. If you click on the link that Amazon Smiles, our link, that every time you order anything from Amazon through Amazon Smiles through our link, we will get a percentage of what you spend. So a very small percent. You don't pay anything extra, okay? So you'd still be spending the same amount of money, but we get a percent of what you spend. Did that make sense, I hope?
Wow.
Yeah, I do that actually with another organization right now. It's a great way to help organizations.
That's a great way of doing it.
So that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And for all the folks out there that own dogs or cats or animals, the first time you order from Chewy.com, which is a wonderful pet place, they sell all kinds of pet products and a lot of holistic stuff, Chewy.com, if you use our link, if you're a first-time buyer from them, we get $20.
Wow.
So
that's great.
Great way.
Score.
Yeah, go buy your dog. Good boy.
Well, I will do one last personal plug, too. If people can order your book on my favorite book site of all time, Powell's.com. I love Powell's Books. It's in Oregon. I love that place. And they only do books of people they really like. So they're very socially conscious. And I'm glad you can find your book there as well. So go ahead and order everything else from Amazon, but get your book through Powell's Books.
If you ever want to order a signed copy of my book, you can order it through our local bookstore, and I can sign it for you, and then we'll ship it out to you. So that's feasible, too, if you wanted a signed copy. Mindfair Books, and I can give them the information regarding Mindfair real quick here.
Well, terrific. Let's go ahead and wrap this up. Give everyone the website address and where they can find you on social media.
Got it. www.healing-companions, that's healing-companions.org, companions with an S. My email is jmiller@oberlin, OBERLIN.net, jmiller@oberlin.net. My number is 1-800-457-0345. If you go to our website, you can then click on our Facebook link and our Twitter link, and please say hello, ask us questions, give us a call. We're here for everybody that needs help or is just interested in learning more about us.
Well, it's been a fantastic interview. Thanks so much for taking the time to call in on a Friday night. And we're going to be airing this on Thursday the 18th. Kevin, any last words for our guests today?
No, I just really want to thank you, Jane. I think the work you're doing is so important. You're helping people, the community, dogs, and I really hope your board and everyone else is happy with having a lot more interest. Because I'm telling you, man, I'm gonna keep this conversation going in the future. It's not the last time we'll talk. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a real honor, and I look forward to continue to speak with both of you and to the public, and any way we can spread the word about the healing power of dogs is fabulous. Thanks so much.
I love it. Well, stay on the line for us, please, Jane. We're going to go ahead and do one last song. We got to finish with Andrew Heller's My Way, of course. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Kevin and I will wrap it up tonight. We've been talking to the amazing Jane Miller. You're listening to Healing Stigma on Left to Straight Radio. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I've traveled each and every highway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do and saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times I I've loved, I've laughed and cried, I've had my fill, my share of losing, and now, as tears subside, I find it all so amusing to think I did all that, and may I say, not in a shy way, oh no.
Back. That was Andrew Heller again with My Way. You can't have Frank Sinatra without My Way. Well, Kevin, another great show. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we might have gotten a bit clinical at times, but it was so interesting to hear. This is it's really groundbreaking what she's doing, and I think Jane is just fascinating, and her whole program is it was just great that she took the time out to talk to about it. You could hear the passion in what she does.
Oh, definitely. She is definitely 100% passionate about it. And it is really interesting. Like I said, when I was doing that research, it is a whole different thing. The stigma around it is so different because it's typical, what you think of as a guide dogs are thought of as bigger breeds, medium to large breeds. A psychiatric service dog can be a Chihuahua, can be a small, what they call the kit poodle dogs, anything like that. And so they have a lot of trouble getting people to understand that, yeah, this is actually my service dog. And I thought she brilliantly talked about how to go about and what to say to different places like that, because it is part of the American with Disabilities Act. So it's very important.
Yeah. Well, you know, I didn't want to talk about it when she was on the show, but you know, when someone puts the word healing in the beginning and they live up to it, I mean, I'm, you know, as our listeners know, the work I'm doing on writing the Healing Stigma book right now is very important to me. And as you do that, it's not just about establishing yourself as an expert, let's say, but it's also about having the time and the space to put down what it is that this life-changing event has taught you. And then healing takes time. It takes that type of, you know, guidance maybe, or a path that you've gone through. And the idea that these healing companions, you know, an adopted dog is also getting a life and a person is getting out into the community. All I can say is from everything I do in the Healing Stigma program, I can say her program deserves that word healing every step of the way. And that's the program that you saw in having, you know, Healing Stigma on Left to Straight Radio. So that was a great example tonight of a program in action actually putting community and, you know, the people that are there into a much better conversational place.
Exactly. It's so important. I mean, it's like we said, it's hitting so many different areas, not only with the pet population, but the prison population and the mental health population. It's just amazing, amazing work.
It's really great.
Good stuff.
Good stuff. Well, good stuff, my friend.
Well, we are going to have a bet. Unless there's a major emergency pop up, we're not going to be talking to our guests live until a week from Thursday. So this again is April. I don't know where I'm at.
Leave that in.
This is August 18th when this is airing. We're taping this the Friday before, but guys, we got a couple of great shows coming for you for the rest of the month, and then September we're bringing Jeffrey Marsh back. We're bringing we're gonna be talking, like you talked last week, we'll be talking about stigma in the workplace and all sorts of fun things. So be sure to keep us in mind every Thursday, live 2 p.m. Pacific time, 5 p.m. Eastern time, right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you haven't downloaded the app yet, please do. You just go to your Android or your iPhone app center. Just type in Left of Straight Radio. It's a free app. Doesn't cost you a penny. You will never miss an episode of Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio. And as a bonus, you'll get all my Left of Straight shows and are standing on my soapbox. So be sure to do that. Follow us the conversation on Twitter at Heal Stigma Radio. The website healingstigmaradio.com has all of our great guests on it. Boy, just a whole mouthful of commercial there, but I think it's really worth your time to tune in. Kevin, it's been great as always. I hope you have a fantastic week and a half here.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to have plenty to talk about the next time we get together. My goodness, but that was really, really a pleasure. And as always, you do a great job. Thank you, Scott.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I can't wait to talk a week from Thursday. And everyone, this is Stigma on Left of Straight Radio. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.